My name is Deb O. Powers, and today is October 13th, 2011. I'm interviewing for the first time John Frederick Jr. This interview is taking place at 25 Beaver Drive in Polebridge, Montana. This interview is sponsored by the North Fork Landowners Association and is part of the North Fork History Project. So, John, tell us about your early background, like where you were born, when you were born.
I was born in Columbus, Ohio, almost in a taxi. I don't think my dad was calm enough to drive. He probably took a taxi. In fact, my mother said they pushed me back in because I was in, before the doctor got there. She said she was big as a barrel. This was in Columbus, Ohio, and then I spent all my normal schooling in Marion, Ohio, and in Ohio State University. I worked for a social service organization. I was a camp caretaker. Went out and fixed things that didn't work. It was an old camp from like the 30s.
That's great.
So, and then I met my future wife. We made a visit out west and we went to Glacier Park. I'd never been to Glacier Park. And then the next year we moved here. But how I found the place.
What year was that?
It would have to be 75 was a trip, and then 76 I came back, but not up here quite yet.
And that year you came up to the North Fork?
It was after I came, I needed to come and find a place to live, and so I found a cheap $50 a month place where the roof leaked, but it was cheap, and I had to go to Eureka to get the electricity turned on. Anyway, it was just a base. And then I had a catalog, and I can't remember the name of the company, but they used to have a catalog of the whole entire U.S. And I found one that interested me. It's what I call the Loon House up north that belongs to Doug Barnes. And I looked at it, and then I found out my wife wanted to have a hostel. She'd lived in them for 4 years off and on. And so I came back and saw this funky, ugly place, a big log cabin, with the front porch. There was a porch to stand on, but it was just like a few logs sticking out. It was supposed to be it was an unfinished porch. I said, God, that place is ugly. I drove up, I turned around, says, that's ugly. Turned around and left. And then later thought about it, and yeah, maybe I could do something with it. And I bought the place of Halloween, 1978.
And where was that cabin?
The hostel.
The hostel. It was right there already.
Yeah, it was there. I've never built anything new. Right. I'd taken a place and done something to it.
So what was it before you got it?
The fellow had like 5 kids. And you know, the kitchen's rather small. Maybe 15 by 25. They lived in it, all of them, one winter. In the attic, which is not an attic, it's just like a crawl space. They did, I don't know how they did it, but they did it. And I know they did it because I had to change the insulation from under the roof to the kitchen ceiling above. So, anyway, he had a lot of kids and he was a house mover and he moved it there.
Where did it come from, do you know?
Glacier Park, it was the McFarland Ranch.
So what are some of your earliest memories of the North Fork, John?
Well, it's kind of an odd one. It was winter time, and I had been at the hostel for a few days, washed some clothes. I had a pair of red long johns, union suit, hanging in front of the stove there. And I had a kind of a welcome wagon visit from Frank Evans. He came over and just welcomed me there, and we talked for a bit. And it was just kind of interesting. He's was quite a character.
He was.
He's hard to explain to other people, but
He was one of the first people you met up here.
Yes, yeah. It was. Mm-hmm. He was.
Mm-hmm. What was the North Fork like in the late 70s? That was quite a while ago.
Actually, I have to go to jump to the 80s a little bit because I don't remember. But in those days, if you wanted to see somebody, he went over and visited him. And like now, where we can email, some of us can email each other, or we got a radio, we can call each other. And if you either go that way or you don't see your neighbors. There was a distinct difference, by the way, at that time, because I moved here in 1980 full-time. That first summer of 1979 was just a summer thing for a few months, and then closed, and then started up in 1980, and just consecutively since then. But what was interesting is back then, until about 95 or so, we had a post office. And that was another way we met people, because we'd go to the post office, which was in the Polish Mercantile, and kind of hang out a little bit, read our mail a little bit, and meet all our neighbors there, and have a little talk with them, what you've been doing, and so on. And that's distinctly gone now. We don't have that anymore. Because people knew about what time mail came and all that, and they would come roughly about half an hour later after when she was due. He was at that time. And we sort of ran into each other. The thing I remember was about the road in the early 80s to mid 80s. I remember I had a Volkswagen Squareback, which is just kind of like a tiny station wagon. And I drove it to the border, and there were one big pair of ruts there. And because the Volkswagen is narrower, I could only put one wheel in, and it'd be kind of cockeyed, drove the way that, like that. It's come a long ways. People occasionally still complain about the road. In fact, somebody came to visit somebody today, and they went out of Columbia Falls a little ways, and it's that part hasn't been worked on much, and they just turned around and came back, went south again. Even today, the northern part is quite nice. Clear to the border, it's pretty decent.
Mm-hmm. There have been a lot of struggles about this road over the years, haven't there?
Oh yeah. That's one of the reasons the preservation was formed.
The North Fork Preservation Association?
The other reason for starting the Preservation Association was the coal mines in Canada that had been, something like 40 years they were threatening to put coal mines in there, and they do it in such a way that their tailings pond where they caught everything, there was so much water up there, so much snowfall, that they would just blow out. And the debris would be in the river, and disregarding the problems of what the silt does to fish breathing well, they don't breed well either because of the change in temperature. It would warm up a little bit, and the temperatures they need for breeding would be not so good. The road was what we started talking about a minute ago, and that was also 82, both of them for 82 for up here, although the coal mine and the road issue was a lot older than that. The coal mine was first about something like 74. It keeps reappearing every so often, even until quite recently. But the road was a big one. In a way, it's bigger than just something that largely affect the river, and perhaps a little bit of air quality from the burning coal to wash the coal and that kind of thing.
So the Preservation Association basically got started around the issues of the coal mines and not paving the North Fork Road.
Yeah, the threat was being paved in 82. There was a hearing on St. Patrick's Day in March of 82. And then people showed up in droves. And I forgot the statistics, but there were a lot more that did not want it paved than wanted it paved. Mm-hmm. And the road was not exactly favorable to driving in those days. I'm sure all the tire companies just loved us up. Well, a different way they love it. Sarcastic love, because our tires kept breaking and we had to take them back and give us a new one.
So, when you first moved up here, tell me about some of the old timers that were around in those days. I guess the homesteaders weren't around anymore, but who were some of the people that were still around when you?
About 1984, maybe it was 82. I met Ralph Thayer. He's the Forest Service guy who laid out those trails that Devo Powers likes to walk.
Did he really? He's the one that laid out all the trails in the Whitefish Range?
Almost all of them. There might have been a few like Indian trails that he just sort of picked up. Uh-huh. But I think he was the guy who did it.
Oh.
In fact, the Dubai Trail is the Ralph Memorial Trail. I think it's 26.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I met him, and he was an interesting fellow. Really, really nice guy. I asked him about, because I heard something about him doing the, what would amount to the rafters in the Mercantile as you're down below looking up. Or if from above they were the floor joists. He said, well, if I had an axe, I would show you how I did it. So, anyway, he was living at the veterans home at that time, and he didn't live a whole lot longer than that.
Uh-huh. Did he build the store, the Merc?
I got the impression he helped a little bit.
Uh-huh.
But I think he built Ford Station, and it his cabin is the one Nancy Hubble has, so I assume he did that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because in those days, there's not too many people who had money to pay somebody to, like they do now. Either you do it yourself or it doesn't happen.
Yeah. He was a surveyor, too. Didn't he do a lot of surveys up here?
Yeah, he surveyed the trails, and then he did. I think he did those, too. In those days, if they didn't have what they call a boundary tree, they would have a boundary hole. And that was kind of an odd marker, but 4x4x4 was a hole in the ground to tell you that was a corner of something. That would be hard to walk into in the woods, I think. And I think it wasn't done too much. But that was one of the things they used, if nothing else worked. I also met Ruth and Lloyd Saunderson. When I met Lloyd, he had lupus, so he couldn't converse very well because he was starting to lose his voice. But Ruth was around a long time, until just a few years ago. I don't know what that would be, a few years ago. I don't know, it was 200 and something when she died. And this was about quite a while before that. In fact, she gave me an old military Jeep, and they're really sturdy, really sturdy. And I looked at it this way, and it was all bent. And I asked her what happened, and she said, oh, a couple was spooning, and they hit a tree. So that's what happened to where my spare parts for my 41 military Jeep came from.
Anybody else you remember at that time?
Well, of course, I mentioned Frank Evans because he wrote for the paper.
Uh-huh.
And then I followed him for 2 years. And the political situation was such that I was expendable. And they kicked me off. And then Larry Wilson started doing it. He was nice about it. He told me that it was happening, which is more than the editor did of the Hungry Horse News.
What was the political situation?
Mr. Ladenburg, Tom Ladenburg, and another fellow were complaining about me to the point that they kicked me off the paper, basically.
Because of your perspective, probably.
Well, truly, there was nothing in the paper that I wrote that I was aware of. I'm sure there was subtle little things that you can infer something to infer something to infer something. But I didn't put anything in there deliberately. But it was just, you have a reputation, whatever it may be, and people assume that rather than necessarily what's really happening. Mm-hmm. Happens all the time.
Yeah, it does. So when you first moved up to the North Fork, it was pretty different from daily life in other places. What was...
Well, the difference, one big difference is, well, now I have a solar home. It's wonderful here in Polebridge. But then, if you wanted water, either you wore your arm out on the pump or have a system like I did, which you wore your arm out starting by a pull cord, your generator. And so you would have a lot of racket as you, in my case, filled up a 500-600-gallon tank in the hostel upstairs. Did that if I was alone once a week or so, but when I had busy summer, it was every day. Mm-hmm. People don't save much water. Unless you live up here, you have a tendency to do that more than other places.
You do. It's true. So, yeah, no telephones, no electricity, no running water, outhouses, wood stove,
yes.
Lots of things. Huh?
I forgot to mention the outhouses. That was a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
Some people never quite got on to that, but I had it for a good 20 years until I moved into this house,
uh-huh.
Or longer.
Now you've got a solar house and flush toilets and... electricity,
yeah.
and
you have a solar house anyway.
I do too.
Not necessarily a solar toilet, but a solar outhouse.
So tell us about what the social life was like up here in the North Fork.
Well, as I was saying earlier, you went to someone's house.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Frank Vitale's and Ellen Horowitz's house about every weekend. And we would make ice cream, we'd crank it out. My job was, I got lots of icicles on the hostel. So I'd pull off the icicles and that was the ice for the ice cream maker, which is kind of a bucket with a crank on the side.
Uh-huh.
I'd fill it up with ice. I provided the ice cream maker too, and they provided the rest to make the ice cream. And it was a little more personal in those days. And we had one recipe that called for 9 eggs. I think now we'd all have real cholesterol problems. We had very many of that.
9 eggs in the ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So wasn't there a whole group of people that hung out up there around that
mm-hmm.
neighborhood, like... Peter Moore, Greg Willett.
There was a Matt, I forget his last
name.
Right now, but yeah.
Yeah.
And from time to time, there'd be other people up here too. They'd be here for a year or so and disappear. I mean, move someplace else. They decided they could do it, but maybe they didn't want to do it because it was kind of rough on the edges, especially in winter. Even now, there are a lot of people that leave in the winter, like I do.
You used to do a lot of hiking up here, too, I remember.
I did, just about every popular trail, and some were not even trails. We went up to my friend Jack Johns and I, he was in his 80s, 70-something,
mm-hmm.
like 75 years old or so when I met him. And then I went hiking with many trails, but we decided to go up Aconcoca. There used to be a lookout up there once upon a time. And we went up there and tried to follow the Forest Service maps of those days are even worse than today. They would have a trail that you couldn't even find it. You couldn't even begin to know where it went. But we there was a trail going up, so we decided if we went down that trail, it would be a lot better than going up, but at least we'd end up in the right place because you just basically went downhill and you'd hit a road. And there was no trail. We came up one where it was half a trail, and then went down one where there was no trail. We ran into Devil's Club. That's nasty stuff. It's as tall as you are, and really got some kind of huge barbs on it. It just made it really hard to get through that. That's what we just down. We just went down the creek bottom and left it. That's real interesting. We did the Review Mountain Loop. We went up Tujuk Creek, hung the left, and there's a trail going that way, and went up to Review, and came back, which is the better way to go, because you going the other way, you just wonder where the trail went. And going the way I just mentioned, you can find your way. Even if you've never been there before, you can do it. Although you're really puzzled sometimes. Anyway, we did this, so I think it was a Saturday, and on Monday was his 85th birthday, and that's when he died. It was one heck of a hike.
Yeah.
And he did it. And he did just what he loved till almost the last minute.
Yeah.
And I respect that.
I remember hiking with him in the 80s.
I bet you do.
Yeah. It was Montana Wilderness Association hikes.
Yeah, I led him for 10 years or so, and then when I started going to Costa Rica, I couldn't get in my schedule properly. I don't think we had email in the earliest days. At least I didn't. So I kind of had to drop it. They wanted the potential hikes in much earlier while I was in Costa Rica, and I just couldn't get ahead enough to do it regularly.
Mm-hmm.
I remember hiking up to you with NASA coin.
Mm-hmm.
You took your own way and went up real high, and your muscles were shaking. And
that
then
big snowfield was.
You went around the snowfield.
Yeah.
I get to hold the French girl's hand and help her across the pretty French girl's hand and help her across this snowfield while you're up high shaking. You found your way back just fine. We just waited a couple minutes.
So tell me about some of the fires around here that have happened in your lifetime in the North Fork.
Well, the biggest one for me personally was the 88 fire,
mm-hmm.
the Red Bench, which was memorable for a number of reasons. The overhead people, well, they found it discovered about 2:30, something like that in the afternoon. And Richard Hildner can tell you a little bit about that. He was the observer with the district ranger, Tom Hope, who were both up there looking at this fire. And they would call it, it's a quarter acre, it's a half acre, it's an acre, just like that, boom, boom, boom. And the overhead that night met at the hostel, because it was the biggest place close. And I had, I got a picture of the chief fire person for the park signing over the park to the Forest Service for purposes of fire suppression. You couldn't find the superintendent that weekend or whatever it was. He couldn't find him, and he had to do it anyway. He was a bit nervous about that, but he had only a year or two left, so he didn't care. He did it. It worked out fine. And then I don't remember. I think it was the next day. It came through Pole Bridge.
That fast?
It may have been the day after, but it was quick enough. Ron Wilhelm said he was up there with his small cat helping to see if they couldn't do something to stop the fire from spreading. No, it wasn't that kind of weather. It was one of those just get out of the way and hope for the best kind of fires. And he said his track vehicle would go 7 miles an hour. And that's the speed of the fire. He was right at it. He just stayed ahead of it. He's a very nervous fellow. And he also, incidentally, I forgot to mention, was a fellow who was the host for the first meeting of the North Fork Preservation Association when people voted to have called that. He was the fellow moderating it.
Mm.
He now lives. He used to be here all the time. And some time ago, he moved south to Columbia Falls.
So when the fire came into Polebridge, I'm sure you were pretty scared that you were going to lose your place.
Well, I thought that because we had a ball field to the north and the fire was coming west to east, that the big yard of the hostel, in fact it was mostly cottonwood trees, which it still is today on that side, would pretty much protect the hostel from any real problems. And some guy decided to spend the night with me, and he got two, they call it shake and bake tents.
Uh-huh.
And we had them. So if we had to, we would go in the middle of the yard, so to speak. It's rather big for being called a yard, but it was rather large. And we just get there, if it came to that. And two Forest Service guys came by and squirted the hostel with some water just before the fire proper hit there.
Mm-hmm.
And when we went in the hostel, we go through the kitchen and it closed the door to the kitchen and go into the other part because better breathing there. The kitchen's a little too smoky.
Wow.
In fact, I'd swear one of the curtains, that the fire was close enough that the fire browned a curtain that was facing the fire.
So it was that close?
Yeah, I had it was the garage that belonged to the Saundersons down there. It was on lot one, which is where I had my horses for a short time. An acre is just too small, but that's what I had at that time. And burn it all up.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Battaglia had got a tractor. I call it Big Red because I had Little Red, the Little Red tractor. He put the logs together to make it.
So what happened to your horses?
My wife was Sharon at that time. She had taken them to town long ago.
Oh.
She just disappeared.
When you heard the fire was happening, she just took the horses.
Well, horses are, I've never been around them, but as I understand, ain't a fire, but as I understand it, they got really stupid around fires. They go right into it.
Right.
The barn's on fire, they'll go into it anyway. So she took them south, and they all got kennel cough. Like dogs get kennel cough when they pass it back. Horses got some variation of that.
Uh-huh.
So they had to be treated.
So the fire came right through here and could have taken the Merck and the Northern Lights and...
Well, actually, if you look on top of the Merck, you'll see there's one or two parts of the metal, the sheets of metal, that are newer than the rest. And that's because the fire, they figure that there was a firestorm. In other words, it's kind of a blow-up. The air is really rushing. That the firestone lifted a little bit of the roofing, just enough to get a spark in there. And the fellow who was the night manager for the fire saw that it was on fire. How he saw it, I don't know, because it was such minimal damage. But anyway, he broke in the front of the Merck. And so he just went up there and hosed down with a fire extinguisher and coughed a lot, I think, and saved the Merck.
Yeah.
And Will Hammerquist's father fixed it. Like, he's a craftsman, a carpenter. He fixed the roof quite a long time ago.
So the fire went through a lot of Polebridge too, didn't it? Didn't it take some of the cabins in Polebridge?
Oh, they did.
Yeah.
There's about three or four or five in here that burnt during that time, just gone.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole fire was like, out of 100, there were 20 that got burnt.
And the bridge burned, the pole bridge.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
It did, certainly did. Usually bridges don't burn, but This one happened to be wood on top of a couple of huge, monstrous I-beams. And they caught on fire. Everything was so dry. Mm-hmm. In fact, on the hostel, I had skylights, just little bitty things. Actually, they were designed for a van. They were so cheap. And so I put them in because that's what I could afford. And there were burnt needles, pine needles in there. In fact, the back of the hostel has kind of a crawl space and a little open space. There were some in there too. And there are little bitty fires in the yard that just burn out because there was no grass to speak of, just a little bit of dry grass to make a little smoke and be gone. Yeah, I remember that better than any of the more recent ones, for well, all yeah. these reasons.
Yeah, because it was right here.
Because you were threatened.
Yes.
By it.
Yeah.
I think I was the only one with the other guy that spent the night with me that was in Polebridge. Everybody else was evacuated. Uh-huh. I didn't know that until the next day.
But there were firefighters here, right? Or were they all evacuated too?
It depends. They do what they can before the fire, and this kind of fire, they just get out of the way mm-hmm. and put themselves in a safe situation. Uh-huh. So I think they were nearby, but you would think they're right here. They're not. Uh-huh. They'd be in a field, maybe to the north, the old hay meadow there, Hay Creek, up in that general way, or Moraine Creek or something like that.
So what made you decide to stay rather than evacuate?
Larry Wilsman, well, at that time there was a guy, earlier there was Mount St. Helens, one guy refused to live. I think he died. But anyway, whatever his name was, that's what Larry Wilsman called me because I stayed. You know, that's stupid. Maybe it's stupid, but I got away with it. There's no problem. So, I was the only one here. Everybody else...
I would think that would be pretty scary.
Well, I had never seen trees explode before, but I had saw it. Uh-huh. If the temperatures around a tree is such that the sap turns to a vapor, boom! I saw one blow in half from halfway up, more than halfway up. I'd never seen that before. And I discovered that the cottonwoods may not burn very well, but the branches burn off, and you just have the trunk that left, charred trunk probably.
Is that what happened to the cottonwoods?
Mm-hmm.
But they were still alive?
Well, they were down in the roots, yeah. Mm-hmm. So they just come up someplace else.
Uh-huh.
They didn't all get that way, but some of them did.
So after the fire moved through, the big part of the fire, there was probably still spot fires around for a while, or?
Yeah, actually I had one of the... I'm trying to remember the nice name for the backpack sprayers. Backpack sprayer. I had a backpack sprayer and I'd go around and squirt some of the trees, like the spruce often, if nobody cut any limbs, they'd go right to the ground and they would be smoldering, or I'd see a little something smoldering, I'd just go squirting. Keep them from the wind from blowing up, because there often is a back burn.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing much of anything here, but there could have been. Mm-hmm. Not because I did anything, but it just didn't happen to happen.
Mm-hmm. So that's fire. There's also been water. Big flood. Wasn't
there
a big flood? 95.
Yeah. My two dogs and I left when it came in the front door. I canoed over to the Merck.
You could canoe all the way to the Merck? From the hostel?
The Merck property are pretty close. So
yeah.
How close was I? 100, 200 feet away. I mean, it was pretty close. The water was right down the road. But it was a little deeper over there for canoeing work better.
Did you know it was coming?
No. Didn't. Up north, somebody like John Elliott, he must have had a radio phone or something because he managed to call the county disaster guy and tell him a lot of water was coming down the river. He was much further north, but they didn't believe it. I mean, there's just no reason to think that because nothing they had in the U.S. picked up on that. They've since done something so that they can tell if this something like that happens again. But at that time, it wasn't there. It's in place now. I think it's something to do with a Doppler effect, they call it. But anyway, they know it's coming in the future. But at that time, they didn't know. And the guy, it turns out, he was slowly dying of cancer. And he just wasn't functioning very well. Anyway, separate issue. I don't think they're particularly related, but he was not well. The guy who was the disaster coordinator for the county.
So the water started rising on the river? And mm-hmm. that's when you first noticed it? Was it was just coming up into your yard? Or how
oh,
fast?
Yeah.
How fast?
The first
was it
clue
in a day?
Was when the telephone went off. That meant the water was about between 2 and 3 feet high because it went into the pedestal and shorted it out. Hmm. That was a clue.
Was it in the daytime?
Okay. Early evening sometime. Mm-hmm. That was still the longer days, it was daytime, there was light. Uh-huh. And in the middle of the night, I went up, checked, got up, and I drove my Bronco clear down to lot one, which is one I owned at the time of the subdivision. Just pulled it down the road where I knew it was a little higher, and it was fine. But I thought, well, that was hard. I just barely made it, so I don't think I'm going to ask anyone to move theirs because I don't think they'll make it. I just made it out.
The water was already coming up into the road and stuff?
Oh, it's all over the road, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There's a dip there.
Uh-huh.
And it was probably four feet deep.
Oh, wow, that's pretty deep. Did you go back to the hostel at that point?
Yeah, I went back to bed, of course.
You went back to bed?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the river rise, it does that.
Yeah.
Of course, it never has before or since, as far as I'm concerned, like that. But I didn't really think it was going to keep coming.
And it did.
And it did, and the next day...
When you got up in the morning...
It came into the house. I don't remember related to the earliest part of the day, I don't remember, but I remember... I started throwing, this happened early in the day, I started throwing television steps upstairs, things like that. It might,
because
if the water came in the house, it would be better if some of the sensitive stuff wasn't there.
Yeah. And it came in the house then?
Oh, it did.
Yeah.
It was 14 inches in the kit in the living room.
Oh,
and. Close to 4 feet, not quite 4 feet, but close to 4 feet in the kitchen. There used to be marks in there you could see. I don't think they're there anymore. I could tell exactly how high it is. I thought holding my hand up and saying about this high was good enough. Yeah, I had a kayak in there. Of course, it floated up and moved. I didn't want it blowing away. It was easier just to put it inside, see?
Yeah.
I did have to go hunting for my propane tank. It had leaked. I had just filled it up, and propane apparently is a lot lighter than water, and it floated away, and psst, all the gas went out.
When I got it, it was empty. Floated down the river?
Oh, it didn't go that far. It went as far as the first little collection of trees. It caught it in a bunch of trees that were close together.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't very far away.
Uh-huh. So you had a lot of damage in the hostel, didn't you?
It was a hell of a mess. It's mud, mostly.
Yeah. I remember the summer after that, a few months later after it was cleaned up, there was still mud all over everything in the hostel, it
mm-hmm.
seemed like. Papers and things like that.
And in the cracks in the wood floor, they're just like 1x4s on the floor. Tongue and groove, and the mud would get in them, and we'd have to take knives, like kitchen knives, and pry it out.
Wow.
It was a mess.
That was pretty much of a disaster, except the cabin stayed there.
Yeah. Now the propane tank is tied down. Mm-hmm. It's staked. Mm-hmm. We had some other close calls, but nothing like that. It just looked like it just came up to a certain point and stopped. Mm-hmm. In 95, however, I didn't know where my propane tank was for about 3 days. And then Jamie Jonkel, Chuck Jonkel's son, was around. He said he saw one over there in a bunch of trees. And so I started walking around, and I found it. And then a fellow named Richard Anderson was over at the Merck filling up his tractor with gasoline in it. And I said, "Say, can you give me a hand?" And he drug it probably about 100 yards or so back to where it belonged. Mm-hmm. And it was quite a while before things were normal. Frank Battali brought me some 100-pounders, so I'd have some propane in the lights in the house, mm-hmm. which was kind of nice.
Yeah.
And then the Montana Woolens Association sent a work crew. It was to help. And it was Carrie Byrne. Her husband's name. Steve Thompson, mm-hmm. Ben Long, and his wife Karen Nichols. There may have been Stormy Good, I'm not sure. I think she was there helping out too. And they did a work day to clean out the hostel.
It's good to have friends.
At that time, Dick Walsh had the Walsh cabin towards Big Prairie, just on the edge. Uh-huh. And North Valley Rescue folks came with some water spray and stuff and hosed it out for him, cleaned it up. Yeah. He was one of the founding members of North Valley Rescue. Interesting times.
So fires, floods, and how about big winter storms? Any big winter storms that got pretty bad?
I'm glad you mentioned that. It was just like the day before Thanksgiving, something like that. And there was 4 feet of powder snow out there. And I'm trying to think of who writes for the Hungry Horse besides Larry Wilson's old guy, older. Be right back.
Okay.
G. George Ostrom! G. George Ostrom was very worried about his son, Shannon. Shannon has something like MD, muscular dystrophy, or something mm-hmm. like similar to that. Uh-huh. And he was up there at Moose City. He was trapped. What was to do? Well, I got on with Lee Downs in his big Ford pickup truck, and we'd go a mile or so, and he'd have to clean the radiator off because it was full of snow. It would cut off the cooling effects. It would overheat. You'd clean it off, clean out the air filter, because it snow, such powder went into the air cleaner too. And so we went clear to the border like that. And almost to the border, I can't remember his name, but a logger came ahead of us with a plow on his pickup, and he was really moving, finished quite the last little bit to Moose City so we could drive right to Moose City with a little easier with a snow plow. And they were down to a couple candy bars. And so they were very happy to see us. What had happened was they had parked their car on that little shelter by that's part of the Border Customs building. Mm-hmm. They'd parked it there, and it wouldn't start. And so They just kind of stuck there until we got there. Anyway, we got them out. They were very glad to see us. But that was about the most snow I had seen. Starts 4 feet of snow, and the next day it's about 3 feet. It just settles 3 feet, 2 feet, and it stayed about like that. That's the most I remember.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I noticed was there's a sign on your wall of your cabin. It says Northport Crusader number 1. Who gave you that sign? I mean, you have a reputation of being a crusader for the North Fork. Do you remember who gave you that?
Oh, I know who made that.
Who made it?
It was Jerry or Richard Wackrow.
Uh-huh.
Wackrow's did. I'm not sure which one of them. Uh-huh. And then there's a picture here that you best describe it. It was part of the thing, too.
Oh, yeah.
That
Thanks to our voice in the wilderness. It's a picture of you kissing a grizzly bear.
Yeah. That was drawn by Carol Vachetti.
And there's a wolf on there, too.
And Cheryl Watts organized this thing at the hostel. And the picture's on the wall here. How many people would you judge to be up there on the picture? Just make a wild guess.
40.
40?
50? I don't know how many.
40 sounds right, but I never counted them.
Yeah.
I never did. But anyway, I got a picture of all the people there, and it was very... I appreciated it, anyway. Yeah.
To appreciate you for all the work you've done up here to try to protect the environment of the North Fork.
Oddly enough, I don't get very many thank yous. Don't. So when I get them, I'm very grateful.
Can you think of any other big struggles up here, environmental struggles, or that you?
Well, the coal mine was a big one.
Uh-huh.
The one I was involved in all the series, mm-hmm. starting in '82, and so 1982 is when it would heat it up again. So I bought a few shares of stock in the parent company called Rio Algum, of the one that was here. Sage Creek Coal was Limited was the name of it. And so I went like six times, and first time I didn't have a second, I made a stockholders' proposal of the company.
So you went to the stockholders' meetings?
In Toronto, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Did that for like 6 years.
Uh-huh.
After a while, I couldn't afford it, and then MWA took a collection so I could go. I would also visit my parents in Ohio, so it wasn't such a hardship as it sounded like, because I'm going to go see them anyway.
So you would make a motion and there wouldn't be a second? What would your motion be, to close the coal mine down?
For this reason, for that reason, for the other reason, and this reason, and more reasons, that recommend that you not pursue it any further. I forget exactly how I put it, but don't do it, in short.
Uh-huh.
And in 1988, I got a letter written in sort of English, it's saying that the Sage Creek coal mine was no longer of significant interest to the Rio Algum. And I called the guy up and I says, what's that mean? It means we're not going to do it.
Yay!
That was good, yeah, yay. That was a yay.
Uh-huh.
And later on, other companies wanted to do it. The first one wanted to use the exact same location. Mm-hmm. Well, after a little discussion with them, they realized that if the International Joint Commission was to get involved, since the mine was identical, it wouldn't go.
Mm-hmm.
So the same company tried it in a different place, and they were somehow discouraged from doing it. And then more recently, after 30 years or more of cajoling the Canadians and trying to be good neighbors, we finally got an agreement between Gordon Campbell, the premier of BC and Brian Schweitzer, governor of Montana, such that they would not have oil and gas in the flight out of BC.
Yay.
Of course, that leaves, they have what they call coal blocks, which are the federal. Those others are provincial. So there's still some few coal blocks up there that belongs to the provincial government. So there's still a little question mark up there, but I think it's going to be all right.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for all your work with that.
I tried.
It was successful.
Well, luckily I hardly was alone, or we wouldn't have got that far. Mm-hmm.
So you've mentioned some of the people up here in the North Fork, and I wondered, like, some of the leaders and characters of the North Fork. You've mentioned a few of them, but can you think of other leaders and characters up here?
Well, he was never a leader, but he was kind of influential. That's Tom Ladenburg.
Uh-huh.
He had on boots, and he would always put one pant leg inside the boot and leave the other one out. He just did this. It was standard operating procedure for him. And if there's always something real rednecky to say, he would say it. He would be the one.
He was definitely a character.
He was.
Uh-huh.
He was that. Yes.
But he put a conservation easement on his property.
He did. Marilyn Wood, still with the Nature Conservancy, managed to get that before they canned her,
mm-hmm.
which was a big one.
Mm-hmm.
When that happened, Nature Conservancy felt they'd done their part here, and they were kind of pulling out of this area, because that was such a big one.
That was a big one.
But later on, when this agreement between BC and Montana, that we would match what they did, they wouldn't have oil and gas, and we in the North Fork wouldn't have any oil and gas exploration. The companies that had put money into exploration wanted their money back. It's not totally unreasonable. So that was part of the agreement, that they would be paid back, the Montana-BC agreement. So the Nature Conservancy of both the U.S. and Canada worked on the fund. They got the price way down compared to what they probably said it was initially, a lot down to about $9 million. Sounds like a lot to me. But anyway, they're raising the money.
Mm-hmm.
And the Preservation Association, which I'm often a perennial president, came up with $1,000 or $2 to give them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was matched by somebody else, by Felder Carey.
Great.
So the Nature Conservancy got back in the area in a different way than uh-huh. they had previously,
uh-huh.
but in a big way. None of us little guys can, little organizations can deal with $9 million.
No.
So.
Ever.
No.
In a lifetime.
No.
That's right. Well, what are some of the close encounters you've had with animals around here in the North Fork?
Actually, someone else might call them close encounters. I wouldn't. I had a bear in my backyard, and I was watching him from the porch. They were just running through grizzly bear.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm trying to remember if I was a mom with a cub or just a female, but anyway, at least one bear just went through. And another time, a bear was a little too close, and to get out of the area, I simpler, if you pull your shotgun to the side, and if you're a great distance, you can, the bear is facing the wrong way, the other way, you can pepper them, encourage them to get out without hurting them any. You have the distance, so it's just like a little hurt. And I did that to one bear to get it out of there. to protect the bear too. It came back and but was caught in the trap. They called him Fred.
Like when Frederick. Was that? How many years ago was that?
Honestly, I don't remember. But Lynn Ogle took a picture of the bear and put the date on it. It's over in the hostel on a picture over there. I didn't take that picture. I left it there.
On your hikes, all your hikes you did in the wilderness, did you have any bear encounters or?
I forgot about this one. I was just with a friend of mine. His name will come to me in a moment. Dick Kuhl, K-U-H-L. We were doing the Review Mountain Loop and coming back on the finer stretch. And it was probably July, and there were still patches of snow here and there. And we could tell a bear was ahead of us. And we watched him from a distance, and he was just standing on the trail looking at us. This was quite a distance. And so we just bushwhacked straight down to the road there. Mm-hmm. That's the only time I can think of right now. I guess I was with close to one in the park at Quartz Campground there, Upper Quartz. And we were at the place you're supposed to make cook your food. And about 50 yards away, or maybe closer, up on a tiny bluff was a grizzly bear watching us eat. So I told everybody, bang the pots, making lots of noise, and it left. So, nothing happened. Sometimes if you know what to do, helps a lot.
It does, yeah. So you've been in the North Fork for quite a long time, and you've lived here full time most of the time.
Never seen a wolverine.
Never seen a wolverine?
No, 30 years, some years here.
Yeah.
32 this year. Uh-huh. I've never seen a wolverine.
Yeah, I've only seen one. That was in the park.
The Preservation Association is writing a letter. They should close the trapping season on wolverines.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they're likely to be listed next year.
There's so few
it's
of them.
Danger.
It's
yeah.
True. Yeah.
And they can get their living is so precarious that just one or two taken out could take out that small population and be mm-hmm. gone.
Right. Yeah.
So you were asked, one of the questions you've written down, tell us about the North Fork social life. Well, how would I put it? It's the wrong place. Oh, what do you do for fun? We hike, we read, we ski, and tell lies.
And tell lies?
That's what we do up here.
Well, storytelling has a long tradition,
well, you can
you know?
Describe it differently.
Yeah.
Elaborate a little bit.
That's right.
That's always
That's always
okay.
good. Yeah. Well, you've been here a long time. What are some of the big changes you've seen happen in the North Fork?
Well, when I came, and when you started coming, the people here were mostly Poe folks.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. we did a lot of stuff ourselves, or it didn't get done, mm-hmm. or you couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
Simple.
That's right.
And now people with money are building really nice places. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just a change. And so we now have a constituency for the North Fork that might be a little more powerful. That's how I look at it.
It's a good way to look at it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So are there any other things that you would like to talk about that I haven't asked you?
I'm sure there are, but I can't think of them at this particular moment.
All right. Oh, let me ask you this. A lot of times people call you the mayor of Paulbridge.
Oh.
How did that happen? Where did that start? And
I think it was like 80 or, it'd be 81, 82 perhaps. I think it was 81. John O'Hara had this saloon And he thought he would do little somethings every week to kind of encourage people to come, get in the habit of coming. And he said, okay, next weekend we're going to have an election to see who is the mayor of Polebridge. The previous mayor was Tom Ladenburg. So Tom Ladenburg was the other potential mayor. And so the next week, Tom didn't show up. So I figured I got the election by default, and even people who didn't know anything about that started calling me the mayor of Polebridge. So that's how it happened. And the pay isn't much.
Yeah, they don't pay you much for that job.
I wanted to make cards. Mayor of Polebridge, responsible for nothing. Take the credit for everything. Responsible for nothing.
That's pretty good. Oh, one other question. You ran the hostel for lots of years, and then you sold it. Tell us about that story, like that transition.
Well, the transition is a little slower than that.
Okay.
About year 17, I had the hostel. I didn't do as well as I did earlier. I wasn't as patient with people, so I started to need people to help me, so I didn't do it all day long. And when it got close to 30 years, I wasn't even there anymore. I would be a substitute for the fellow. And Oliver Meister, a German fellow, had been coming since 92, was running the hostel. I got him a green card. Is really not what it is. It's an alien certification of labor is what it's called. And I managed to get him one. Had to hire a lawyer to do that. And I did that. Then, after 5 years, I sold it to him. But that's a little quicker story because he wanted to buy it. He wanted to buy it. But when it came the time for me to want to sell it, he had cold feet. So Debbie Kaufman and her husband Dan used to have the Merck. And one of the things Debbie did was buy a property and flip it. She would fix it up and resell it at a greater price. And so I talked to her, had her come over and talk about buying the hostel. She promised me that she would keep it within the family and never sell it. It would be there where she could send people, her family and stuff, when they visit her here, or she could live there herself. Well, Oliver didn't take to that very well. And anyway, he bought the hostel after that.
Yeah.
He took a little nudging.
I didn't know that story.
Well, yeah, there's probably a lot of stories you don't know.
So, and you still live pretty close to the hostel.
Yeah, well, when I bought this place, I wasn't planning to sell the hostel.
Uh-huh.
It's just that
you needed some space.
I needed more space than what I had.
Yeah. After 30 years, that's a long time. Or almost 30 years. How long was it?
20-some.
Yeah. Yeah.
I could spend 5 minutes trying to figure it out, but it's not that big
a
deal.
Yeah, it's not that big of a deal. Well, John, you've been a really important character in the North Fork for a long time, and I appreciate this interview with you.
Well, if you're going to call me a character, I'm not sure I like the interview.
I think that's a good word.
Oh, okay. I'll take it.
I think it's a good word.
Of sorts.
I think it's a compliment because it shows an interesting personality and creativity and not just the regular old run-of-the-mill type person. I think the North Fork is full of characters.
It is. They end up here.
Yeah.
Some of them do better than others, like, what's the name that burned down the yurt?
I don't know who that was.
Well, you should. It's right near you there.
Oh, right.
I just can't think of his name. He would have a little dog on the road, and he would make the dog circle around, make a little circle, and keep going. He was always on the road with the little dog, Bubba. and Bubba died.
Yeah, lots of characters on the North Fork. That was a great interview, John. On behalf of the North Fork Landowners Association and the North Fork History Project, I'd like to thank you for your time.